morning. Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams. There are tens of thousands of New Mexicans who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. It's a condition that causes memory loss, dementia, and other health problems, and it doesn't just affect those who get diagnosed with the disease. Most Alzheimer's patients are looked after by family members, essentially unpaid caregivers who can suffer financial, emotional, and health problems of their own over the course of caring for their loved ones. We want to hear your stories this morning and your questions about Alzheimer's. Give us a call at 277-5866 to join the conversation. We have an excellent panel joining us today. Chris McCaffrey is in the studio with us. He's program director at the New Mexico Alzheimer's Association. And Dr. Gary Rosenberg, former chair of the UNM Neurology Department and current director of the new Memory and Aging Center at UNM. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Well, Dr. Rosenberg, why don't we start with an explanation of what Alzheimer's actually is. Can you walk us through what exactly this disease is biologically? I mean, how would you describe the process to a lay audience?
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and also to talk about our new center, which is quite early in its life. Alzheimer's disease is generally in the elderly. There occasionally are younger people in their 50s, but it's a disease in the 60s and 70s and on into later life. It generally begins with memory loss and also some problems with word finding, language, and the early signs are sometimes very difficult to determine, and there's a period of time when people have complaints of memory loss, but they're not.
Dr. Rosenberg, I'm sorry. Can we have you switch microphones? We're having a little bit of a technical issue there.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
Much better.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. I'll start over again.
Sure. Sorry about that. So
I was just saying that the symptoms begin with very subtle findings, generally some memory problems, memory complaints. At that stage, it's sometimes noticed by the family and sometimes not. Often the person who's working with someone who's developing Alzheimer's disease notices it. This can go on for a year, maybe even 2 years, and eventually it becomes obvious that the memory problems are not just simply age, forgetting things. And they're more serious. And this is the stage when usually somebody seeks attention from the medical profession. At that point, it's relatively obvious with our testing that there's some memory impairment, usually some language involvement also. And this stage, which we often call mild cognitive impairment, can again go for another year, 2 years, even longer, and it's not necessarily Alzheimer's disease. This is one of the problems. We don't know exactly which way it will go at that point. Some people stabilize and other people continue to have problems. And then eventually, and this is usually in the third, fourth year and on, other functions are impaired. The ability to cook is lost. There's also difficulty with daily activities. More care is needed at that point. And then we finally make the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. That's the clinical picture. Unfortunately, there are other diseases there are other problems that can look like that. So it's important to go through a reasonably good diagnostic workup to make sure it's not a problem with thyroid, with vitamin deficiency, particularly B12, and other types of problems. There's a whole list of things. So that's the sort of typical picture. We have some new ways to diagnose the disease, and I think that's the reason it's important to have a careful evaluation. The changes that are going on in the brain involve the laying down or deposition of proteins that are abnormal. The The typical ones that come in first are called amyloid, and that accumulates in the brain, and then eventually a protein called tau. And the reason these are important is that we can now measure those in the spinal fluid, and the diagnosis with a lumbar puncture is becoming more and more important in terms of being certain of what you're dealing with.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of people might think it's just normal aging at first. I mean, does that lead to a delay in diagnosis a lot? I mean, do people get diagnosed with Alzheimer's later than maybe they should, and does that cause complications in terms of progression?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think that we cannot really be certain at that early stage what's going on. That's why we use the term subjective memory loss, which means the person has an awareness of it, the family has an awareness of it, but we can't see anything when we test. At that point, generally we try to do more lifestyle modification, things like that, not necessarily treatment with the drugs. And then when it gets a little bit further on, we do start some drugs to improve the memory. So it's really not, I don't think it's so critical at that very early stage to do things other than modify your lifestyle, which is probably not a bad idea anyway. Mm-hmm. But once it becomes clear that this is a progressive process, then it is important to get treatment. And now there's a whole several new encouraging studies that are now being done, and hopefully we'll be able to bring some of those to New Mexico and the new center.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about some of those later. Chris McCaffrey at the Alzheimer's Association. I mean, you interact with Alzheimer's patients a lot. Give us an idea of how big this issue is in New Mexico right now in terms of numbers. How many patients do we have?
Well, what we're looking at in New Mexico is 36,000 people dealing with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, and over 106,000 people self-identify as a family caregiver, as a dementia caregiver. So the numbers are pretty huge. I mean, we're looking at an estimated cost of about $1.5 billion just for our state in terms of unpaid care that's provided. So really, it's kind of everybody's issue. I mean, with these numbers, it's not really sustainable the way we're headed.
Unpaid care, meaning a family member caring for their loved one at their own expense. And fortunately for us, we're joined by a caregiver right now in the studio. Vivian Martinez is caring for her husband, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. Isn't that right, Vivian?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about how you got that diagnosis and a little bit of your own history.
My husband was a sitting district court judge in the criminal division, and he was having some memory issues, and we kept going to try to get a diagnosis, and they kept telling us that it was stress or, from his job. And then finally he had an evaluation. It was the long evaluation. I forget what the name of that is.
Neuropsychological testing.
There we go. Neuropsychological.
Okay.
Testing, and that's when he got diagnosed. So that was 2 years ago in June of 2014. So after that, we went to see two or three neurologists to verify that and got the same diagnosis. So here we are.
So started with memory loss, thought something might be wrong. And then,
yes.
Right. And I guess that happens a lot. Maybe not a lot of patients kind of come in themselves on their own saying maybe there's a problem. Is that right? Or is it usually family members?
For us, he kept insisting it was just stress from the job. And uh-huh. I knew things were getting placed in different sections at home. And he was just doing a lot of odd things that usually he doesn't do. So I kept going back and we kept trying to figure out what was going on. So we weren't surprised. We were devastated, but we're not surprised that there was some sort of diagnosis. Hmm.
I think that typically it is other family members who notice the changes more so. But I think what was unique in this situation, of course, was Vivian's husband's age. And so I think when people present for a diagnosis and they're under 60, Alzheimer's isn't really the first thing that comes to mind. The younger onset diagnosis is more rare.
And your husband was a judge, isn't that right?
Yes, he was a judge at the criminal division doing a lot of high-profile criminal cases.
Right. Well, If you have a story to share about living with Alzheimer's or questions about where to find help, please give us a call and join the conversation. You can call our local number. It's 277-5866, toll-free 877-899-5866. You can also send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our webpage at kunm.org. Well, on the phone with us is Miles Copeland. He's Secretary of New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services Department. And Secretary Copeland, thanks for joining us. I'm wondering, what efforts is the state putting in to supporting caregivers like Vivian? We just heard a little bit about her history, and let's hear from you.
So, Ed, specific to folks who are dealing with Alzheimer's or the dementia, we help to fund the Alzheimer's Association and their Savvy Caregiver Program, which I think they can tell you is a real transformative experience. It really does help to make life better for people who are caregiving for loved ones with Alzheimer's disease or other dementia. If you are interested in any of the services that we offer to caregivers in general or specifically of Alzheimer's or other dementia, I encourage you to call our Aging and Disability Resource Center, their phone number 1-800-432-2080. So in the last couple of years, we have laid out strategic plans for how we're going to help to support people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias and their loved ones, their caregivers, and then caregivers in general. We have 419,000 family caregivers here in New Mexico each year providing unpaid care for their loved ones. And one of the steps that you can take to make sure that you're getting the assistance that's available that you need to be good in that very difficult job of taking care of your loved ones is to call our Aging and Disability Resource Center. They'll assess your needs and then connect you with the services that are available to help meet those needs.
Chris just told us about some of the costs that the Alzheimer's issue is burdening the state with. I mean, we do have an aging population here in New Mexico, and I'm wondering, Secretary Copeland, if this means that we're looking at an increase in Alzheimer's cases on the horizon.
You're exactly right, Ed. So as Chris probably mentioned, your greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age. Our aging population expands about 80% over the next 14 years by 2030. And with that, unless we do a better job controlling some of the modifiable risks for Alzheimer's disease, you would expect to see the sheer number of people with Alzheimer's disease here in New Mexico grow. Chris could probably correct me on this, but I think that the current number of folks with Alzheimer's disease in the state is about 38,000 taken care of by over 100,000 family caregivers. And the number of people that is projected by, I think, 2025 is 43,000. So we see pretty significant growth in the next few years among people with Alzheimer's disease, just like we do with everything else that's associated with our aging population, because our aging population is growing quickly the 2030 year.
So baby boomers are getting older, more cases like Alzheimer's that we can expect to see. Are we prepared for this growth? I mean, can this potentially
Our best on that front. I mentioned the New Mexico State Plan for Family Caregivers that we just authored and the Alzheimer's Plan that we authored back in 2013. Among the big challenges that we have are connecting our family caregivers with resources that are available. So none of us come to caregiving with an education for it. And even those of us who are professionals in the field of aging have a difficult time when we're dealing with our family, knowing exactly where to turn, making the right choices, being comfortable reaching out for help. And so those are some of the big things that the plan attempts to address. Care coordination and getting people to the resources that they need is one of the things that was identified as the most important help by the family caregivers, and thanks to AARP, we surveyed over 1,000 New Mexicans in putting together that state plan for family caregivers that I mentioned. And that was what emerged as their number one thing that they said would be helpful, was not more programs, but information about programs, because the system of long-term services and supports is complicated, and we need to do a better job of hand-holding folks, identifying people who are new to caregiving and more effectively getting them to those resources. So again, not to give out the phone number too much, I apologize, Ed, but 1-800-432-2080 is our Aging and Disability Resource Center. They can assess your needs as a family caregiver and then connect you with the Alzheimer's Association. In particular, our operators have been trained, if you mention memory loss, if you mention Alzheimer's or dementia, to directly refer you, ask you if you want a call from the Alzheimer's Association. And even if you're not a caregiver of Alzheimer's or dementia, but maybe just caring for a parent who's getting a little more frail as they age, I'd encourage you to call that number to get connected with the services that are available, things like home-delivered meals, things like adult day service, things like in-home care for your loved one. We realized that a lot of our family caregivers, like most of us, live in the spot where they don't make enough money to privately pay for all of the things that might be helpful for them, for, let's say, a home care agency to spend a lot of hours in their house, and have too many resources to qualify for Medicaid. And for those folks, senior services, which are available throughout the state without regard for your finances, are a great solution in a lot of cases for people.
Well, we do have some of that information, the phone number and other resources online, and we're going to get back to it in just a minute, but we need to take a break here. We're talking about Alzheimer's and the challenges it poses for patients, for families, for the state, with Dr. Gary Rosenberg of the UNM Aging and Memory Center, Chris McCaffrey of New Mexico Alzheimer's Association, and Vivian Martinez, who's currently caring for her husband after his diagnosis. Secretary Miles Copeland of the New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services Department is with us on the phone. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back.
KUNM needs you to come in and help us answer calls during our fundraiser, Saturday, April 9th through Friday, April 15th. We provide breakfast bagels, lunch from House of Bread, dinner from B2B, and snacks for all other shifts. It's easier than ever to sign up for the 2 or 3 hour shift that suits your schedule or for your favorite show. Just log on to KUNM.org and look for Click Here to help KUNM answer calls.
For a new era in medical coverage, we consider an integrative approach to health that cares for the whole person and includes gentle, natural techniques, not just high-tech medicine. And we learn how some aspects of integrative health will be supported by provisions of the Affordable Care Act. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for The Search for Well-Being, a special documentary from Humankind.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. We're back talking about Alzheimer's impacts on patients and families, ways to find help. If you've dealt with Alzheimer's, what problems have you run into? Do you have advice to share with other people who are facing the issue? Do you work in the healthcare field and want to share your experiences there? We'd like to hear from you. So if you want to weigh in or ask a question of the panel, the number is 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Toll-free number, 877-899-5866. You can also join the conversation on Twitter, where we're live-tweeting the program. Our handle is at KUNM News, and our hashtag is HealthNM. Vivian, Secretary Copeland was just talking about some of the expenses that can go, especially with middle-income patients who don't qualify for Medicaid. Is that something that you ran into when you were dealing with your husband's diagnosis?
That's kind of becoming our biggest struggle because, you know, he didn't qualify for full retirement. So our retirement is based on the number of years he worked, which was 9 years. We also have medical insurance that is a lot more expensive. So we have a lot of expenses as a middle-class family, but when we start calling to get any kind of services, whether it be care during the day or maybe dropping him off at maybe Share Your Care, we're going to have to go and kind of be on a sliding scale because our income is very large in comparison to someone that's elderly and retired. But we have kids in college, we have two adopted children, you know, we have a house payment that we're still making, so we weren't ready to be in full retirement. So it's really difficult as I called all the units because I will have to get him in either a home care environment or in one of the facilities. It all depends, you know, how his progression goes. We're looking at anywhere between 5 and $10,000 a month. So either we
$5,000 a month.
Yeah, I've called everyone. We've gone to visit homes. We've gone to, you know, see the facilities, and it's self-pay for middle class people like myself and several of the other younger onsets.
Chris, what help is there available for people like Vivian?
Well, we, as Miles mentioned earlier, we at the Alzheimer's Association are part of the larger aging network. And one of the core programs we offer is something called a care consultation. And that's where we can meet with families to really look individually at their situation, what their specific diagnosis is, how far into that progression they are, what their financial resources are, as well as their manpower resources in terms of other family members being able to help. And then we can sort of help them decide what the next steps ought to be, and whether that's taking care of the legal issues regarding powers of attorney, guardianship, those kinds of things, helping them to start to look at the costs, as Vivian has done, so that they can begin to shore up those resources, because she's right, the cost is very high, and particularly for assisted living, because Medicaid, even if somebody qualifies for Medicaid, that doesn't really cover the cost of assisted living.
I was going to say, because, I mean, if you do qualify for Medicaid, it seems like being lower income would come with its own host of problems.
Well,
in
certainly.
Terms of caring for, you know, for your loved one.
Certainly.
Are lower income patients, middle income patients, higher? I mean, Dr. Rosenberg, is there like a, is that a predictor of the likelihood that you would have Alzheimer's? I mean, do you see more cases in certain income groups?
No, not necessarily. There is a relationship between level of education and the onset, but this is probably just that we don't notice it in someone with a very high IQ until there's been a dramatic drop, where someone who has a lower IQ, and particularly a very low IQ, it comes out earlier that there's a problem here. People can cover up the problems in those early stages. I think education is the only factor that we know of.
Really? I mean, is that kind of a use it or lose it with your brain kind of situation? I mean, the more you...
Well, we talk about cognitive reserve. In my... You know, my practice, I see physicists from Los Alamos, some of whom are quite high IQ, and it takes a while to realize that they're having problems because they're able to find other ways to get around.
Yeah, the cognitive activity is really encouraged. You know, we don't know specifically what causes the disease, so we're not able to say what you should do to prevent it. But certainly one of the risk factors seems to be not having that cognitive reserve. And I think a lot of times people associate that term with intelligence or education, but really what we're talking about is using parts of your brain that you don't normally use,
yes.
You know, like brushing your teeth with your non-dominant hand, or shopping at a different grocery store than you normally do, taking a dance lesson. And so I think, you know, the reference to physicists, we hear that a lot. Oh, my husband was so intelligent. Well, intelligence itself isn't necessarily going to mitigate the risks of developing the disease.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean it mitigated.
Of course.
But it just it's harder to detect, is what I was saying. But I also should say that we now realize that it's not just the Alzheimer's process, but there are other factors that influence the progression rate. And one of the things that we're learning a lot about now is the impact of vascular disease. In fact, that's one of the things that our group has been researching for some years, and NIH is now getting very interested in that. If you have longstanding hypertension untreated, you have hyperlipidemia, you're smoking, you're overweight, you don't exercise, and you begin to get Alzheimer's disease, it will be accelerated, mm-hmm. The progression. And so what we're trying to do now is, as Chris said, we're trying to modify some of the lifestyle activities of people and even the Alzheimer's trials that are going on for drugs, incorporate cognitive training and exercise and other aspects because they're all related.
Right. Well, cognitive training is important. Using your brain is important. But obviously, Vivian, your husband is a smart guy. I mean, he was a judge, working hard, and ended up with early onset Alzheimer's. I mean, what kind of toll has that taken on you personally as a caregiver? I mean, has that caused any health problems of your own? I mean, how are you coping with the stress?
Right before my husband got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I was battling breast cancer, and I am cancer-free, so I'm excited about
that.
But it was very devastating because we dealt, again, with cancer. IQ's very high, and he was really just in denial even when we got diagnosed. So he went into a really bad nine-month funk right in the middle of my diagnosis and devastated to have lost his job. So our whole world fell apart. We had two little adopted daughters. I was battling cancer, and my husband had been diagnosed. At that point, I couldn't work, so both of us lost our jobs. So when that happened, and I'll mention, you know, Judicial Standards has a job to do, and they really wanted him off the bench. And all I can say is I was so grateful for the district court judges, because they all band together, and they now I'm going to get emotional. And they got all of his caseload and helped us to get disability and get the diagnosis, because we had to do that. And so it didn't affect the work, because they were wonderful in doing that. And he was able to retire instead of just be let go. A lot of the people in younger onset just lose their jobs. They get fired because they have memory issues. So for us, it was devastating financially. Our income went less than half, and our insurance went up. And both of us are at home. I'm caring for him now, and still have to do some surgeries regarding the cancer, but I'll be okay. But we went from a very, we were very involved in the community. He was working, we were both hardworking, and all of a sudden we both were sick. And we had to pick up the pieces, and now we're just really raising awareness. We're living life as best we can. And I just wanted to mention, as he said, my husband has gotten very into playing tennis, going out with a group and to museums for walks. And the physical activity for this, all of these gentlemen, has been incredible. They are doing great. Mm-hmm. They are happy. I can't express how important it is to do the physical activity and not have the stress. I've noticed now that my husband has no stress. He is better, and the medication has absolutely helped kind of settle things.
Do you qualify for Medicare if you get this diagnosis at an early age?
You do qualify after 24 months. We have a 24-month waiting period. So I'll just give you an example. He went from paying $250 a month to $1,200 a month insurance because we have family. So when he gets Medicare, that'll help a little bit.
Well, I wonder if the state has any resources available to supplement that. As Secretary Copeland, that'd be a question for you if you're still with us. I mean, 24 months is a long time to wait for financial help, especially if you have to, you know, quit your job or cut down on your hours to care for your husband or wife or family member. What is the state doing? Are there any options available financially in that kind of case?
Yeah, it depends an awful lot on your different situations, Ed. So to that end, I'd encourage you to give a call to the Aging Disability Resource Center, again, 1-800-432-2080. As Vivian and her situation points out, there are a lot of very difficult situations that our family caregivers are facing, particularly people who are in the spot of a diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's. And both at the state level and at the federal level, I think that we have gotten better, but probably still have more to do to more swiftly meet the needs of people in that situation in particular. But the resources that are available are dependent on what the specifics of your situation are. So that's why I would encourage you to give a call to the Aging and Disability Resource Center. Right.
Not a one-size-fits-all solution, I guess.
Right. Correct.
Let's go to the phones. Peter is on the line with us from Albuquerque with a question. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Interested in diagnosis, the spinal fluid diagnosis and the neuropsychological evaluations. I I imagine that neither of those are inexpensive, and that to try them right away would may be discouraged. But how far away are we from getting a prompt diagnosis if you feel that you're compromised in some way?
Dr. Grubb.
Yeah, I think I can answer that. Well, this is one of the challenges that we're taking on at the new Memory and Aging Center. There are very few resources in the state, physician-wise, to care and diagnose patients with dementia. So we will have available multiple physicians. We'll have the neuropsychological testing. We'll be able to analyze the spinal fluid. And much of this can be done through research with no cost. NIH is funding a large study we have now where we do neuropsychological testing, we do spinal fluid analysis, and we do very high-level imaging through a collaboration with the MIND Research Network. The cost of the lumbar puncture is not that high. The cost to analyze for the Alzheimer proteins, amyloid and tau, is now high, but we do that in our laboratory ourselves and with no cost. So we hope to provide that service as part of our attempt at getting patients diagnosed earlier. Neuropsychological testing is paid for by insurance companies, and it does help a lot because it separates out what we call executive function, which is organizational ability, from memory and language, the executive dysfunction being more characteristic of the vascular types of dementia, while the memory and language is more Alzheimer's. So and the other thing we're going to try to do at the center is take part in these national studies that are going on. And there's a number of very interesting studies that are coming available to people internationally, international studies, actually. And once we get the center going, we can be part of those, and that will take care of the cost. There'll be access to these new drugs, which we hope will be slowing the process down, maybe even stopping it.
And what's the timeline for getting the center going? You said once we get it.
January 1st was the start date. We're now renovating some space. We're expanding the clinic. Several full-time positions for full-time neurology care. So I would say in about another 2-3 months, we should be up and running. We just hired our coordinator. We'll have a website and all the other things you need. But we've been doing the research, for over 10 years. So a lot is in place, and we're just going to be expanding the clinical aspect of it.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. Let's hear from Leslie, who's on the phone with us from Santa Fe. Hey, Leslie.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I just wanted to ask, my mother has a long-term care policy that covers some portion of some in-home care or residential facility, but not all of it. And I'm wondering if there's any way possible to become the agency to receive that money and take care of her at home.
Thanks for your question, Leslie. Chris, that might be a question for you to answer.
Yeah, and if Miles is still on the line, he could probably speak to this as well. But contacting the Aging and Disability Resource Center is probably your best bet because there is a Medicaid program that will sometimes allow a family member to be reimbursed as a caregiver through one of their Medicaid programs. But it does require a financial qualification. And the Aging and Disability Resource Center can help you determine if you're eligible.
Well, you're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show live from the University of New Mexico, where you're talking about Alzheimer's. It's a growing problem and one that our panelists say we should be taking very seriously. And we want to hear from you. Have you cared for someone with Alzheimer's? Have you gotten a diagnosis yourself? If you want to weigh in, the number to call is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866, locally in Albuquerque. Toll-free number, 877-899-5866. Send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org or tweet @KUNMnews. You can use the hashtag HealthNM. We'll be right back after a short break.
Hank the truck had served so well, hauled everything, helped friends to move, went on adventures in the mountains. Basically, Hank had become a longtime friend. But when at last Hank couldn't run anymore, his owner decided in one last magnanimous gesture to make Hank's end have meaning. She donated Hank where his essence lives on in another friend, KUNM. You too can help two friends. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Christian DeQuincy, author of Blind Spots. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how common cliches distort our understanding of science, philosophy, and spirituality.
Saturday mornings at 6 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. Do you have questions about Alzheimer's, about treatment options, help with caregiving, risk factors? Give us a ring, 277-5866 in Albuquerque, 877-899-5866, toll-free. Send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our Facebook page. Got some phone calls on the line that we'd like to get to. Brendan is on the phone from Albuquerque. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, Dr. Judge, we don't know what's going on. It's causing problems in court management.
I'm sorry, can you start all over? We didn't hear the first part of your question.
My question?
Yeah, we didn't. We picked you up halfway through your sentence.
Okay. Essentially, as someone who's working in the judge's courtroom, we didn't know how to support the judge. We knew something was going on. We didn't know what that was. And while we have an obligation as attorneys to, you know, report what we think is a problem, and there can be an investigation by the bar, that's kind of an insulting thing. And so just on a humane level, and where it crosses over with the professional realm, what can someone do if they see symptoms that they think might be endemic of some larger cognitive issue or at least some health issue?
That's a good question.
Way to be supportive.
So if somebody notices something that might be Alzheimer's, how do you deal with that if you're not a family member? If you're not...
Yeah,
that's a tough one. Ideally, you would have some relationship with the family, at least enough to be able to raise that question. But I can tell you that there's still a lot of stigma attached to the word Alzheimer's disease, and so people are somewhat defensive against hearing that term, particularly maybe if they are aware that they're having issues. So it's delicate. Another option, of course, is to contact the Human Resources Department. But again, you know, if somebody is doing it in a sincerely kind and humane way, as you referenced, that's really all you can do. There's not sort of unfortunately, a magic way to avoid the defensiveness, but we can be as considerate of it as possible.
I think, say something?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Vivian.
I just want to kind of talk a little bit about this because I really think when you do have an employee that's an outstanding employee and does an amazing job and goes to work every day and does, I mean, my husband was doing great. And then all of a sudden, yes, things started slipping. So as an employer, I think you have to realize there is something going on and you have to be sensitive to that. And yes, you send them off to neurological testing. That makes sense. But where I think people don't understand, or employers, you know, they do have to get their jobs done. But what they don't understand is the impact it has on the individual and their families. And if they would just get a little more informed about if it's memory loss, let's kind of find out what's going on. Let's support them. Let's send them over to get evaluated, whatever we have to do as employers, so that you don't just send them off, get the evaluation, and then tell them. I mean, for my husband, they said, you know, today's your last day of work. He went in on a Thursday. On Friday, he couldn't go back into the courtroom. And it was devastating. And as I said, judicial standards had a job to do, and the judges had a job to do, and they did support him. But there was no meeting with human resources. There was no support. I had to call and request from Judge Nan Nash, give us a little time. We've got to get disability going. I mean, we will lose everything. And again, they took it upon themselves to help us out. But a lot of others really just got fired and were never able to get the diagnosis. They just lost their jobs.
Can you fire someone just for having a health problem? I mean, is that even legal? Miles, do you have an answer for that, Secretary Copeland?
Yeah, so in the research that we've done for our plans, what is legal is if someone can't perform what are called the essential functions of the job, then employers are sometimes obligated to act. It is a very difficult situation, both for the individual and for the employer, too, you know, that wants to be sensitive and supportive.
That is very tough. And I mean, I'm wondering, how can you support employers to help them see the benefit of supporting caregivers? I mean, what initiatives are underway?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ed. So, you know, with unemployment as low as it is, you have a difficult time just getting enough qualified applicants, has been my experience. And with family caregivers making up about 20% of our population at this point here in New Mexico, it just doesn't make any sense. You are cutting off a valuable human resource if you don't take steps to try and support your family caregivers to make it workable, just like you would for caregivers of kids, right? I mean, if you're a parent and if you're an employer, you want to do things that make it viable for parents who are good, qualified workers to be able to work for you. And the same is true with family caregivers. So public awareness as far as our employers around the state goes is one of the initiatives that we have underway, because there are a lot of things that we can do as employers, making our leave policies friendly to family caregivers that enable them to continue to work, to continue to be good, knowledgeable employees, to bring their skills to bear to help out your company, or in my case, your department. And we want to make sure that our employees around the state are educated about what they can do and the value that those family caregivers bring to them.
So we need an effort not just to support Alzheimer's patients themselves, but to support the people that are caring for the Alzheimer's patients.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. If we have any Alzheimer's or dementia caregivers out there who have not yet taken Savvy Caregiver, which is the free to the public class that we fund partially through the Aging and Long-Term Services Department, offered by the Alzheimer's Association. It, again, is a transformative class for folks, and I'm sure that Vivian can speak to this some, but it helps you to understand the behaviors and the most effective ways of communicating with folks who have Alzheimer's in a way that makes your life as a family caregiver a little bit easier and makes life better, too, for the person that you're caring for. It keeps you out of a lot of unproductive arguments and conflicts. It just helps out an awful lot.
Well, because I guess being a caregiver isn't as simple as just saying, I'm a caregiver, okay, I'm going to watch after my loved one. I don't know from experience, but I'm assuming that there's quite a bit that goes into that. I mean, what do you have to learn? What kind of an undertaking is this?
I can answer that if you want. I mean, you have to understand the disease, and everybody thinks they understand Alzheimer's, and none of us understand what's going on. And I took the Savvy Caregiver when Ken first got diagnosed in immediately seeked out Alzheimer's Association, and it was an incredible course that just really taught me what was going on in the brain, how to deal with different behaviors, all about the medication. It was unbelievable for me to be able to take that class and come away with so much information. I was in devastation mode at the time, so I didn't feel like I had really... Chris is a great instructor, and I knew that I needed to take it one more time, so I just finished taking the class again 2 years later. And it, again, I was able to just get so much information and so many tools for my toolbox to kind of help Ken move along instead of get him angry or get him kind of frustrated. I understood how to deal with the personality changes and the dips in the disease and the cloudy days. And so it is, I tell everyone out there, if you can go to this class, it is the best thing. I mean, for us, it became our lifeline. And Alzheimer's Association has become our lifeline. I mentioned to everybody when I had cancer, I had a navigator that took care of everything. I call Alzheimer's Association my navigator. They have the resources for the attorneys. We didn't have our paperwork in order. We thought we did. My husband was an attorney. And when you get sick with this kind of disease, you've got to hire an attorney and take care of all the paperwork. And Alzheimer's Association referred us to the right type of attorney. They didn't give us an attorney name, but they referred us to the right type of attorney that we needed to talk to.
A lot of complications and complexities to deal with, especially if you're new to the issue. And it sounds like from what Vivian's saying, Chris, that support and coping strategies are an important part of this caregiver class that you guys are giving. Is that right?
Yeah, it's critical. Really what we know in looking at caregivers, I mean, being a caregiver for anybody is difficult, but when they look at just dementia caregivers, some troubling things kind of come up to the surface. Dementia caregivers are only half as likely to utilize their own health care, for example. They're twice as likely to develop physical and emotional problems as a result of the stress. So what we know really works for these folks is it's sort of a three-pronged approach, like a tripod. Education is critical. Again, we take for granted what Alzheimer's means. And what usually happens is people oversimplify it and they think of it as a forgetting disease. But what people really have to understand is that by definition, dementia is a condition of global deterioration. So it affects all areas of cognition, not just memory, but reasoning and judgment and language and all these other things that we kind of take for granted. So educating them on what the disease is and more productive approaches to working with somebody. You know, you don't argue with somebody who has lost the capacity for reasoning, for example.
Stigmas, too, I would assume. I mean, I don't really see so many people listed as dying from Alzheimer's in obituaries, I mean, which is kind of strange when you think about it because it's such a common disease. And, I mean, you can educate on stigmas in your class or dealing with them, but maybe it's a bigger societal message that we need to be getting out in terms of let's get rid of the shame that's involved in this. Sure. But let's go to another call. Ben is on the line with us from Albuquerque. Ben, hi. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Thanks for calling. What's your question?
My question was in regard to some Alzheimer's symptoms. I had a great aunt who had Alzheimer's, and I remember, like, as it progressed, she lost a lot of her appetite, and I was wondering, was that more of something just affecting her, or is that a more common symptom?
Dr. Rosenberg.
Yeah, I think it depends on the stage of the illness. Actually, people can go for a very long period of time. The average length of the disease is anywhere from 5 to 10 years. And it's only in the last few years that the really serious symptoms occur. So I wonder at what point that happened, because many people maintain their body weight and their exercise right up almost to the end of the illness when things become very difficult. So it's really stage dependent.
What about other risk factors? You spoke a little bit about what puts you at risk. Well, how about this? Instead of risk factors, let's talk about ways to reduce your risk. What do we know about that? I mean, how can people listening try to avoid contracting this disease?
There's a big effort now to modify the progression of the illness, not because we don't have a cure or a... It's even hard sometimes to think of an actual treatment. We have things that slow it down. So what we are working on now, and studies are coming out, the exercise is an excellent way to maintain things, social connections, trying to watch what you eat. We have studies now that are showing that certain diets are actually better. These things are being worked out. We have a visitor at our center now from France who's working on a way of preventing not Alzheimer's disease per se, but the memory loss that goes on earlier than that by modifying multiple factors, and one of them is fish oil. And that depends on whether you have low levels in your red blood cells or not. So we'll have diagnostic tests that will pick out certain types of things that will help, and then we'll be able to give people a little more precise advice about how to slow things down. And I think this whole concept of prevention, I think, is going to rise up and become very important.
And it seemed you mentioned fish oil. I mean, Glenn from Hemis Springs sent us an email asking if there are any validity to non-traditional treatments like coconut oil or other foods. I think I read a story recently saying that blueberries might be the way to cut down on your Alzheimer's risk. I mean, how is someone out there that's not a doctor supposed to make sense of all this?
It's very hard. And that's the questions that I get all the time. The blueberry part is probably people thinking about antioxidants, and we do feel that this has some problems with, the oxidative metabolism of the brain. No evidence to support that. So that's why it's very nice to see some actual large studies. And the one I'm talking about is about to be published, is a very large study out of southern France, run by the Dr. Valis and his wife. And they're going to show that using fish oil at high concentrations does slow down memory loss in a certain percentage of people. And these are the people that have low red blood cell.
Let's go. We're very short on time, and I want to get to James from Bernalillo really quickly, James, because we only have a minute. You have a question about hereditary Alzheimer's.
Yes,
is that right?
That's correct. My grandfather had it, or he had dementia. I wasn't diagnosed. My mother had it, and I'm starting to see evidence of it. Is it hereditary?
In a small percentage of patients, it is about 10%, and there's a lot of work now on the gene, multiple genes that are involved, and there are some studies on familial Alzheimer's disease trying to treat that early. So it is in some people, but it's rather unusual. The majority of people do not have the hereditary type.
Well, thanks for your call, James, and thanks to all of you for being here. Chris, I know that there is a big conference for caregivers that could be a big resource for people listening.
Actually, we have our fifth annual professional conference coming up next week. That's Wednesday the 23rd. We start at 8. People can register by calling 266-4473 or 1-800-272-3900. Or they can visit alz.org/New Mexico.
We'll have that information on our website as well. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Vivian Martinez, Dr. Gary Rosenberg of the Aging and Memory Center, Chris McCaffrey of Alzheimer's Association, and Aging and Long-Term Services Secretary Miles Copeland. Thanks, everybody, for coming. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, kunm.org. We're podcasting the show on iTunes, too. Jefferson White engineers our show. Kaveh Movahed manages the phones. And Rashad Mahmood was our producer today. We had help from Anna Landy as well. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and the Kanama Health Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for listening.